Pleasure to be back here at this table on a less snowy day than it was last Thursday. Just to refresh your recollection, we had initiated this presentation in a manner to kind of give members, new members particularly, some better understanding of what the department does. We had worked through our construction codes and licensing division. We had worked through our workers' compensation division. We have next the OSHA division, and followed up by our apprenticeship and wage and hour divisions. And then we're going to go specifically into the change items as reflected in the budget that you will have before you this session. So with that, let's just start rolling into OSHA compliance. As indicated here on this PowerPoint, OSHA compliance enforces the OSHA Act and standards that ensure safe and helpful working conditions for Minnesota workers through on-site inspections, issuing citations for non-compliance, interpreting standards, helping employers understand how to comply with those standards. This is the traditional OSHA program that I think most members are probably somewhat well acclimated to. Some numbers, approximately 130,000 employees were touched by OSHA compliance inspections during calendar year 06. We exceeded our outreach and education goals by 40% in that time period. And we are in the process of developing, and actually we're in the process of going through fairly significant beta testing on a new information management system, which will greatly further our productivity levels in OSHA. And this will be the first of its kind in the United States, and by far the most advanced of its kind in the United States. All right, but the sibling to OSHA compliance is OSHA consultation. This is what many would refer to as the voluntary arm of OSHA. These are safety and health consultants that employers contact the department. We then send out our OSHA consultants, and they do safety screens, safety analyses with respect to those particular work sites. So it's a free service to employers, and is highly, highly utilized. It also administers some other program areas, as well as our safety grant program, which is a 50-50 match to help employers put in safety equipment and safety training. It has a labor management safety committee component. It has a workplace violence prevention program, as well as a log safe program, which is a program specifically designed for the logging industry to offset high work comp rates within that industry sector. Also in the OSHA consultation program, a new program area that I just signed into implementation back in January is our construction safety pilot program. This is one of the first in the country. It will expand what we call our SHARPS program, which is our very detailed, relationship-oriented safety process that has been primarily used in the manufacturing areas. We are expanding that into construction now. And so the Gopher Stadium will likely be a participant in that. The new Twin Stadium, once they get grounded, will likely be a participant in that. The Maple Grove Hospital will likely be a participant in that as well. All right, this is just a quick look at the expenditures and the financing by fund within the OSHA unit and the CCLD, construction codes and licensing piece, right? That's the top one. All right, the next unit of practice within the department is our labor standards unit. It's our labor standards as well as an apprenticeship program unit. It's a combined unit. Our labor standards unit takes jurisdiction over primarily chapters 177. And from a legal perspective, they take jurisdiction over labor and employment laws, minimum wage, overtime, child labor, prevailing wage, parental leave, employee rights regarding termination of employment and wages due. They take in about 25,000 phone calls a year. We have, in the last, I guess it was about 2 years ago, I broadened that unit's ability to reach out particularly in the minority areas, we added a community service component to that unit, which gives us better opportunity into the Hmong, Somali, and Hispanic communities. That unit also takes ownership to the state's apprenticeship program. We are the body that, we are the state agency that approves state apprenticeship programs. And again, from the expenditure and a financing by fund look, this is how it's done. This is how we, where the money's spent, and that's where the money comes from. Okay, and then quickly, our general support division, which reports up to my deputy commissioner, Michael Huleston. It takes the functional business for the agency, which with regard to communications, legislative relations, which is John Rakowski, our financial office, which is run here by Cindy Farrell, our IT unit run by Cindy Ballantyne, who's on my left, our research and statistics arm, as well as we have a BLS component, Bureau of Labor Statistics, as well in there. We have a legal arm, and which also does some litigation work for us. Now I'm going to turn the presentation over to Cindy, who will walk us through, or walk you folks through, the change items that you'll see in our budget request this session.
Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Cindy Farrell, and I'm the Chief Financial Officer for the department. This next slide is just a one-page summary of our six change items, and I will walk through each of these, the highlights of each of these on the following pages, and a more detailed description of each of these change items can be found in the governor's budget document. The first change item you may have seen with other state agencies is a compensation adjustment. This provides an adjustment for estimated increases in salary and benefit costs for state employees. It includes 2% per year for general fund activities and 3.25% per year for other funds. And these appropriation increases are needed just to maintain our existing service levels. The next change item is some fee changes in our construction codes and licensing division, which we call CCLD. And there are actually four parts to this change item. In 2003, license fees collected by the boiler and high-pressure piping units were increased to help resolve general fund budget shortfalls. And this proposal would reverse those increases and would bring fees collected more in line with the cost of providing those services. The license fee reduction amounts to $254,000 per year from the general fund. And the next two pieces actually go together. Our stakeholders have recommended increases to the contractor recovery fund, increase in claim limits in order to provide additional financial relief to homeowners who were harmed by the actions of their building contractors. Currently, the annual license fee paid by building contractors includes two parts. The first is $100 for the actual license, and the second is a fee to the contractor recovery fund, and that fee varies from $100 to $200 depending on the licensee's gross annual revenue. This proposal would redirect $30 of the base license fee to the contractor recovery fund and increase the contractor recovery fund by an additional $30. The net result to building contractors will be a $30 increase per year, and the net result for the general fund is a loss of $521,000 per year. The contractor recovery fund would be increased by $1,030,000 per year. Finally, increases are also proposed to the electrical inspection fees for just under $3 million per year. These additional revenues will be used to help improve inspection services throughout the state and to expand our educational offerings for the electrical field. The next change...
Representative Mahoney. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Farrell, could you explain to me, I think it was the last budget cycle, When the Board of Electricity was moved over to Labor and Industry, there was a surplus in that particular fund of approximately $4 or $5 million. And why, if there was a surplus 2 years ago, there is now an increase in fees?
Sparrow.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mahoney, I don't believe there was a surplus in that account. However, I believe it was 2 years ago, $4 million was transferred from that account to the general fund to help resolve general fund budget deficits.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
So then it was borrowed, so to speak, transferred, whatever term we're going to use. Are we paying that? Where in the budget does that $4 million get paid back?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, we're not addressing in any way that $4 million here. We're proposing increases to fees that will help support increased services over future years. We're not replenishing anything that was transferred previously.
Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
So was that $4 million that was transferred, was how is that being accounted for? I mean, that was $4 million worth of inspection fees that were removed from the Board of Electricity that consumers had already paid for their electrical inspection. Have those consumers been paid back, or is that a line item in the governor's budget someplace to continue paying that particular, for those particular inspections that had not been completed at that point? I'm just trying to figure out where that money went and if there's a way to track it.
Carol?
Mr. Chairman and Representative, the electrical inspections had previously operated on a prepay. Consumers or requesters of electrical inspections would pay in advance for their inspection, and that money would sit in an account until the inspection was actually completed. And so that made up this $4 million that was sitting there. It wasn't really a surplus. It was money that people had paid for the service, and the service hadn't been completed. Since that money was transferred 2 years ago, the activity is now working as a pay-as-you-go type model, so that those individuals who are paying for the inspections that are done now.
What happened to the $4 million worth of inspections? I mean, did that just get put onto the budget going forward, or was that a surplus amount of dollars that just kind of vanished? Or because we had this particular argument 2 years ago, you and I, and you know, it wasn't actually an argument, a discussion more. And I couldn't figure it out then. I'm still not figuring it out. So I'm still just trying to figure out what happened to that $4 million. And who's paying that $4 million worth of inspections? I mean, is that now an ongoing state liability? Is that ever accounted for in the inspection division somehow or another? And now, 2 years ago, there was a surplus, and now we're coming back looking to increase fees. So I don't understand that.
Ms. Farrell, can you?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Mahoney, this transfer was made before it was part of the Department of Labor and Industry. I guess I don't know how to respond. The money went to the general fund, and so current people applying for inspections are paying for whatever inspections are done now.
Mr. Chair?
Representative Mahoney, I don't know the issue either. All I remember is that they took that $4 million bucks and paid for other things with it in the general fund. I think the question that Representative Mahoney's asking is, since the people had already prepaid for their inspection, how did their inspection get done, and did they pay again, or did somebody else find the money somewhere to finish those inspections?
Yeah, and I still don't understand how we can go from how we now need to charge more for electrical inspections when, until it got to the Department of Labor and Industry, there was no need for a fee increase in electrical. I mean, they seem to be doing just fine. So that's some of my questions. And
Commissioner, you get paid the big bucks for this answer. Come on.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I can't speak to the history prior to my responsibility without you. But I am vaguely aware of the money being sent over to the general fund. The inspections were done. How it was financed, I just have to get back to you. I'm not aware of the inspections not being completed. Tom, you have any?
Inspections were done.
Well, Mr. Chair,
the fee increase, as you see outlined in this change item, was a proposal that came through the board of electricity.
And Mr. Chair,
yes.
I personally, and as a representative of people who buy building services in my district, I'm going to have a hard time supporting any kind of fee increase for electrical until I figure out where that went to and how it was done and why it's needed, because there's no logical reason that I can see at this particular point. I really feel like, I'm not done yet. I really feel like this is a three-card Monte game with $4 million of people's electrical inspection fees, and I'm not happy with that one. And until I understand it, I'm going to fight that fee increase in this committee all the way.
Commissioner, you can probably get that information for Representative
Mr. Chair, Representative Mahoney, I'm sensitive to your feelings. We'll talk to you about it. The fee increases themselves came from industry, not the department. So we will, John Schultz is the individual I need here to talk about this, and he's not here today, and he's the one with the details. I can assure you.
Members, I want to remind you, Commissioner, that we got four major bills up today, so five probably.
So and another way to approach this, Mr. Chair, I can stick around for questions.
I think
outside of the of this
you and Representative Mahoney should get together staff and find out
talk through it.
Where the $4 million went and how it got the inspections got accomplished. Representative Welford.
Thank you, Chair Rukavina, and to Representative Mahoney. Actually, I did some research on this because I was going to introduce some legislation in the past session that would have repaid some of these funds transfers that were made. And so I talked to the Board of Electricity and some other individuals about this issue. And I asked them, I said, well, if we have this surplus, but it's actually ongoing so that you could use those dollars that people paid in to pay for those inspections when they were actually going to occur. That's what the money was supposed to be used for, and there was a little additional money there, so they took that money out. And I said, well, if that money was to stay there, couldn't we essentially reduce the fees at some point that people would have been paying for their service? And that could have been done with that $4 million that was taken away. Instead of having to increase fees now, if there was money that was actually there that was a surplus that people paid into this account for their service to be provided, we could have ended up reducing fees in the future. And we could introduce legislation to pay back that $4 million that was taken out of there. It's a possibility. So we can talk about this in the future, but I'm really disappointed to hear that fees are going to be increased after dollars were taken out of this account. I think that, that was unfortunate that it happened then, and now we're talking about fee increases when dollars were there and it could have been a surplus.
All right. Ms. Farrell, Representative Gunther?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Commissioner, is it true that we still have private electric inspectors going and inspecting various buildings that are doing it? They're still private and are paid from these fees and on a basis, and that a good share of the $4 million was taken from their surplus. I was there when it happened, and I feel a little disappointed that we're raising them too, unless that is necessary to pay those inspectors an increase for doing what they're doing, and I certainly would not want to stand in the way of doing that.
And Mr. Chair, Representative Gunther, to the first aspect of your question, you're right. These are independent contractor, private inspectors, that's how the process works. But with respect to the fees, I'd have to I just have to get back to you.
And we,
like I said, it was an, it came from industry, it came from the IBEW and other folks who
you can get that information to Representative Mahoney. Okay, why don't you continue, Ms. Farrell?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The next change item is a construction code consolidation. The construction code fund is a new fund proposed to support the consolidation of the construction-related activities within DLI. Currently, three of the activities, residential contractors, boilers, and high-pressure piping, are funded from the general fund. And the remainder of the activities, plumbing, electrical, and building codes, are funded from the special revenue fund. Our change item is to consolidate these activities into a single fund. It would consolidate all revenue and expenditures into this new fund. And the consolidation of this funding, of these funding sources, would help to support the structural reorganization necessary to create efficiencies and to provide more streamlined services to our agency's customers and stakeholders. It will also ensure that our customers receive the service that they're paying for through their fees. This change item would also dedicate penalties that are collected by the division to be used for providing safety grants. The net cost of this change item to the general fund, after we remove all revenues and expenditures, is a little over $1 million each year of the biennium. The next change is a request for additional funding in our OSHA compliance unit. Last year, the federal OSHA program provided us with a tool to analyze the staffing levels within Minnesota's OSHA program and compare those with federal benchmarks. This analysis took into consideration such elements as population, industry mix, and number of injuries and illnesses. The result of the analysis was the determination that Minnesota's OSHA program is understaffed by 12 FTE. Since this is a 50-50 matching program with the feds, we're requesting an increase in our appropriation from the Workers' Compensation Fund of $460,000 per year. This appropriation will allow us to request a similar increase in federal funds. And these funds will be used to expand compliance inspections as well as compliance assistance activities. The next request is $200,000 per year from the general fund for our labor standards unit. As this program is the agency's only pure general fund activity, it has suffered considerably from general fund budget cuts over recent years. This change item would add 2.5 FTE, restoring the unit's staffing back to fiscal year 02 levels. And these staff will be used to support the unit's primary activities of investigating complaints and responding to telephone inquiries, as well as making improvements to the prevailing wage survey process. The final change item is a technology initiative proposed to enhance the department's ability to transact business electronically with workers' compensation system participants, such as injured workers, employers, insurers, and third-party administrators. We would be developing a two-way interface to our workers' compensation database, allowing those entities to provide information to us and receive information back from us electronically. The one-time cost for the development of this interface is $200,000, and ongoing costs of $90,000 per year include hardware and software maintenance, ongoing web security services, and one technical staff person to support the application.
That's all we have, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moll.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Commissioner, back to the OSHA work that you're doing. You said that your agency is short FTEs. You're trying to obviously provide service, increased service and workplace safety statewide, yet your satellite offices were recently closed last year in Bemidji and Hibbing. Granted that that's a long ways geographically from the current agents now that are in place. Maybe you could inform the committee as to how we in northern Minnesota, with perhaps the most dangerous business, forest products industry, those factories have are some strong workplace safety issues, concerns. how can your agency keep them safe when you're, you know, a half a day's drive away?
What we've done, Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, as you correctly reflected, we did close in one person office in Bemidji. It wasn't, it was, I think it worked out with us, as well as Babbitt. But what I've done to alleviate that, and as you also know, Representative Moe, the individual in Bemidji wasn't sanctioned to do business in Beltran County, which posed some issue for us. We have actually added staff to our northeast and northwest quadrants by 50%. We've added 50% more officers, ocean investigators. And we are doing, particularly in your area, some of the St. Cloud folks are working up too. We've redesigned the business cycles. And so we're having teams of people run out of St. Cloud and Duluth doing multiple day swings throughout, particularly your area. So, in essence, we have more people up there than we had before. Now, granted, there's not an individual that's housed in Bemidji any longer. We've got 50% more OSHA presence in northeast and northwest Minnesota than we had a year ago. And when you track fatalities as well as OSHA complaints up in that region, well, we're seeing the most significant increases in those activities is in the St. Cloud and the Duluth areas. Now, I'm not trying to take away the need for other areas. That's why we have added, like I said, 50% more staff to that region. But where I see fatalities and complaints generated, those are the higher concentrations are within that Duluth and St. Cloud quadrant.
Mr. Chairman, we've had this conversation, and you know what I'm going to say, but, you know, from St. Cloud to Bemidji, you know how far that is? You know, that's if you leave here and go to St. Cloud, you're a third of the way to our house. And it's, again, that distance from Bemidji, a little bit further to Duluth. So if we have a workplace fatality or other injury situation, I know your guys kind of make that route occasionally to visit workplaces, but there's a long time before they get there. And it used to be the response was minutes. Now it's hours, perhaps longer.
Right. Well, if it's a fatality in Bemidji, in your jurisdiction, granted, I can't have someone there any minute. Although I couldn't before because that individual wasn't allowed to do Beltran County. But
Potlatch is in Hubbard County, by the way.
We're talking about what we've talked about in the past. Yeah. But the swings we are the business loops that we are now performing are not one day. It's not, our guys and gals aren't going up in the morning, spending 2 or 3 hours in those jurisdictions and then going back home. These are multiple day swings. So they are there for an extended period of time under general investigation kind of route.
Well, Commissioner, maybe what we could do is you could get some comparisons for Representative Moe and maybe for all of us. I'd like to see where your employees are stationed.
I can tell you, Mr. Chair, Representative Moe, our employees are stationed in Duluth or OSHA.
I'm talking for the whole department. Maybe you can show us.
I can tell you right now. It's Duluth.
I don't want you to tell me right now. I got other bills to hear. You can get that information and put it in writing for us, okay?
Thank you, Mr.
Any other questions, Representative McFarland?
Mr. Chair, I hope this isn't going to stir the pot, but it's a question I've always wondered about. When we're talking about promoting safe and healthy working conditions with OSHA, how does a smoking ban, how does that work? And I just need a brief answer. Is it federal OSHA laws are different?
I don't think they work regulate smoking.
That's right. Okay. OSHA.
But you could stir things up with that question. So.
Yeah, we're ready.
Okay, no further questions. Thank you, Commissioner. And if you can get that information on your where your staff and all your different divisions is located statewide, we'd appreciate it. Okay, Representative Loeffler, are you in the audience? There she is. Representative Loeffler, welcome to the committee. I think Representative Slocum would probably wouldn't mind moving this bill. Would you, Representative Slocum?
What?
Would you mind moving House File 1032?
House File 1032. I'm shuffling.
Yes. You recommended to pass and place for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm delighted to have my first opportunity to be in the Higher Education Committee. The goal of this bill is to foster our state's ability to attract and retain the smart young talent that we're going to need to have a successful economy in the future. And most of us attended at the start of session a all-day retreat at the Humphrey Institute in which we had an opportunity to look at long-range the challenges that are going to confront us as a state. And I guess Tom is kind of a smart name because we had the Tom and Tom show there, only it wasn't featuring Mr. Chairman. Instead, it was the Tom Gillespie, our state demographer, and Tom Stinson, our state economist, sort of telling us what's going to be happening. And I just have a couple on the handout that's just gone around, a couple of slides from that. The first one you'll see is the Minnesota, it says Minnesota's boom generation begins turning 65 in 2011. And the lighter colored line is the 18 to 24 year olds. That means we're going to have lots of people retiring, and we're not going to have the young people there to take their place. This is the first time it's ever happened demographically, and it's going to create a lot of competition for the workforce, which is the next slide, which shows nationwide, this is happening everywhere. We are going to have a tremendous dependent population, people over 65, 80, and on, and not enough young people to fill all those vacancies that are created when the boomers retire. And there's going to be, according to the smart people that we've hired as state economists and demographers, a huge competition within the United States to attract bright young people to keep our economy going. We know that the majority of college graduates stay in the state in which they graduate. And that just makes sense. Internships allow them to develop professional relationships that lead to the first job offer. Many of them make social connections and form a peer group and a community such that when they graduate, they don't want to leave. And so we know that one of the best ways that we're going to be able to compete and retain young people is actually to start recruiting not just from our local high schools, but from high schools across the nation. And one of the barriers that we have right now is we have resident and non-resident tuition in some of our campuses. And we know that everyone is price conscious right now. That's one of the number one things that when families and their children are looking at where should I go to college, the price tag is one of the first things they look at when they get those lossy catalogs. The current situation that we have in Minnesota is mixed. MinSCU has, and that chart you'll see in the last part of the attachment, it lists all the MinSCU campuses. We have 12 campuses that already have this as their policy. They have one rate tuition. We have 5 campuses that have a conditional access to resident rates. Typically that is children of alumni get a chance, even if they've moved out of state, to have their children come to their alma mater at resident rates, or academic talent, where they're trying to recruit a really bright person who's expressed an interest. And then we have 16 campuses that still have a resident, non-resident tuition difference, and the range of dollar differences is really dramatic, from a low of $22 per credit to, I think, around $200 in some of the higher ones. The University of Minnesota, which we know is constitutionally separate and can't be directed in its policies, although we can advise, is currently studying this issue, but you should know that the Morris and Crookston campuses already have adopted this policy and have for some time. They have one rate of tuition. Crookston has found this particularly a very useful way to maintain a wide variety of programs on that campus because, you know, that's an area that's demographics are changing. They don't have as many young high school graduates graduating in the area. Currently at Crookston, 10% of their student body is from out-of-state, non-reciprocity states. So that means we're not counting North Dakota, Wisconsin, the states with which we have reciprocity agreements. They're from California, Montana, Wyoming. They've proven that by casting the story of the quality of the programs that we have, we can attract people from other states and fill our campuses and our classrooms so that we can offer a wide range of opportunities, even in campuses and parts of the state that have a shrinking population of young people. And so I think that this is the type of policy that we ought to move forward on now, because before we hit that demographic wall, because we know that one of the best recruiting tools that any college has is the word of mouth from alumni. And when people graduate from our colleges and universities and move because of job opportunities to California or New York or wherever across the state, they're going to be talking about their college experience with people who they meet who are looking nationwide about where to go for their children's education. And I think we ought to start building that base and that pipeline now in order to compete. And with that, I will be glad to answer questions.
Questions of Representative Loughran. Representative
Johnson. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative Loeffler, I like this bill for many reasons. Number one is in 7 years, we're going to have 11% fewer Minnesota kids to go to our institutions of higher ed. And that's in a time when we're going to need trained employees more than ever before, because that's going to start in 2 years. So this also reduces the necessity of a DREAM Act, because we're all going to be the same, so we don't have to worry about that issue. And I really think that this is something that we're going to desperately need, and I'd much rather get with Wisconsin kids than them getting Minnesota kids. So if we can start this ahead of them, we're going to have the momentum coming our way.
Representative Bryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Loeffler, I agree with all you've said philosophically, but I have two questions. One is there a fiscal note that goes with this bill? And the second relates to that. Have you visited with Minsky officials on this?
Mr. Chairman, yes, I have gotten a fiscal note that I actually want to pursue further with Minsky, because I think their assumptions may have been somewhat limiting, in that they did give a fiscal note of $8 million a year, which is where they took the current non-tuition resident, as I understand it, their current non-tuition resident assessment across all those campuses and said that would be the price. They have not, from what I can tell, factored in the fact that this is going to attract more students onto those campuses and actually who will bring tuition with them. As Crookston has demonstrated, this actually is a way to recruit and attract students into only partially filled programs and campuses. And so I think we need to explore that further with some real-world analysis of the colleges that have already adopted this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The second part, did you get feedback from the Minsky system on what their feeling was on your bill?
Mr. Chairman and Representative Brainerd, I have been in touch with Jerry Janicich, who is our the representative. I have been being coached.
He's Johnson in Slovenian.
And
he's son of
and he said he would pursue that. I don't know that they have, you know, Minsky, and you know this more than I do. I'm still learning higher ed. But Minsky, at some point in time, and I don't know when it was, adopted this sort of campus by campus, you get to set your system sort of policies on tuition. And so I think that makes it a little harder for an organization that sort of adopted that sort of every campus for themselves sort of approach to develop a system stance. And I have not been informed that one has been adopted at this point.
Is there anybody from Minsky, Mr. Ullman, or anybody want to comment on this at all? One way or the other, if you don't, that's fine.
Mr. Chairman, I could comment on that point. Would that be right?
You go ahead. Hey, you work for Minsky, I guess.
You
might not after this comment, right, maybe.
I'm wary of questioning Minsky's fiscal notes. However, Bemidji State University a few years ago went to no out-of-state tuition, and there wasn't a cost to the university. We got more students from out-of-state, and they paid the in-state rate. So it was about a wash for the university.
Representative Loeffler, I suggest you press him on that issue a little bit. Mr. Zetterberg, would you care to comment on anything about the university on this issue or not? No? Okay. Is it kind of a wash for the university and Crookston and Morris?
Crispin, certainly.
Okay. All righty. Any other questions? Thank you. Representative Severson, excuse me.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler. And I guess my original question was already somewhat answered on the fiscal note, but I think one of the issues we've talked about and one of the bills that I've got prepared to push in into the hopper is one that kind of front-loads the actual cost of the student. In other words, statutorily we say we want to approach as much as 67% of the cost funded by the taxpayers for the student's tuition. My bill basically says that in the first year that the actual student pays the 100%, the second year they pay two-thirds, third year they pay a third, and the fourth year the taxpayers fund completely. Part of that process is because I think we lose a lot of students in the first 2 years because they jump into the process thinking I'm going to try this out, and then after a year of the taxpayers funding at least half of their education, figure I think I'll go a different road. We've lost those individuals out of the system, and we've lost that money out of the system. I think your bill here presupposes that this is going to recruit people to the state, which is going to increase the cost of the taxpayers because they're already paying half of the bill. And I think we need to keep that in mind. If in fact, the numbers were to bear out that we recruit these people and they stay in the state, I think it's a tremendous tool. But I think there's some fiscal implications here that, you know, we've talked about lowering tuition. I think this would exacerbate that situation because we put more students in. Taxpayers have to pay more for more students. Can you address that?
Mr. Chairman, and Representative Severson, I can't address your particular proposal because I don't know enough about, you know, tuition strategies, but I can say that I think for those classrooms that otherwise would have been two-thirds full that are now 100% full, we're going to bring in new money into the system that we wouldn't have had there, and you're still going to have that professor at the front of the classroom, whether you have, you know, if the average class size is 20 and, you know, you've got 16 students enrolled in that major. I think in some campuses and some programs it could actually make you more efficient. The other situation, I think, is that our ability to pick up the cost of the state support of our higher education system is based on our tax collections. And we have, as a state, been much more successful than many other states because we've been blessed with really good intellectual-based companies, whether you're talking Medtronic, whether you're talking the Mayo Clinic. I mean, we have a national reputation, and we have some our disproportionate share of Fortune 500 companies based here. The reason I'm told they're based here is because we have people with good work ethics and quality skills and training that they got out of our higher education system. In fact, I've been told by corporate executives that they have a hard time recruiting people to Minnesota from other parts of their company. Once they get them here, they can't get them to move out because of a quality of life and because they want to see their kids in our education system. So I would say that I think you need to, as a committee, debate these policies. If you get into this seriously, you might want to consider inviting our state economist to help you put this in perspective, because I think it is a number of different factors that come into play.
And just a follow-up question, Mr. Chair, and Representative Loeffler, do you have a number of how many classes are two-thirds full or three-quarters, or do you have some kind of estimate on that? Because my feelings are that St. Cloud is bustling. I mean, it is most of those classes are full to over full, so I'd be interested to see how much more capacity there is in the Minsky system.
I think that's probably a question for Minsky and on this, Representative Loeffler. Representative Gunther, did you have another follow-up?
Yeah, just one quick one. If you take the statistic that 60% of those young people who go to Minnesota colleges stay here and have jobs here, and the average wage is $70,000 per year for a four-year degreed person, the Department of Revenue collects a lot of taxes from these people in the ongoing years, and I think it does pay back. And if it does have a fiscal notice, just for the first few years after that, it's a negative fiscal note because we bring it back in.
Okay, no further questions then. Representative Loeffler, thank you for bringing this bill.
Thank you, Mr.
Forward.
Chair.
Representative Hartman, House File 938. Representative Hartman, if you want to move your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House File 938 to be recommended to pass and laid over for possible inclusion in the higher education omnibus bill.
Thank you. Go ahead, Representative Hartman. And you have some testifiers.
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm pleased to author this bill. It was brought to me by the students, and we heard from them the first month and a half of committee. I think the chair started the committee in the right way, looking at the students. We all heard through the campaign, the gubernatorial campaign, both candidates talking a lot about tuition reduction and tuition being too much of a burden. For me, this is very personal. My dad never could have worked his way through college under today's financing system. My dad came from a farm family in Forest Lake, 11 children. He was a waiter on the Great Northern Railway, married two children, worked his way through college. And
he had to take care of you, too, at the same time?
That's the way he got through college. He had two kids and small little apartment. There's no way he could have supported the family and gotten through college on the waiter's salary at the Great Northern Railway. No parental help at all, not even a thought of it, without tuition being affordable. Remember Monty Butte? He told essentially the same story. He graduated, I believe, the same year as my father. And now my dad owns a successful business that employs 114 people. You know, this pays dividends for the state of Minnesota. We talk about fiscal notes. We're going to have negative fiscal notes in the future. This is going to bring huge return on investment. These 114 people, I can assure you, would not be employed at the level that they are today if my dad wouldn't have gotten his degree from the University of Minnesota in 1970. And I'll just let these guys say a few words about the bill.
Go ahead. Identify yourself.
Okay. My name is Rick Howden, and I serve as the vice chair for the Minnesota State University Student Association. And we would just like to say today that Representative Portman's bill finds a solution to the massive amounts of student debt that we are going through and which you've heard in this committee by funding the Minsky budget and providing for a tuition freeze. That's going to help our students keep their costs down and keep the quality of education in the Minsky system high. The cuts made to the Minsky system were made up mostly by our students, and it's time that burden is taken off of the students and once again have the state invest in public higher education. And by investing in higher education today, you will make a positive impact on the students and the future of the state. And I just wanted to make a comment on Representative Portman's comment about the economic and investment in the state. And for every dollar that the state pays, $10.87 is returned in economic activity to the state by the Minsky system.
Thank you. We'll hold off on questions until. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Scott Fomo, President of the Minnesota State College Student Association, and I promise I will not make this a dissertation today.
We got to start getting you your full-time job wrong here. You're showing up all the time.
Everywhere.
You've heard a lot about student debt. You've heard us over and over talk about our two-year colleges being second highest in the nation with tuition and fees. The students did bring this bill forward, and I would like to thank Representative Portman for sponsoring the bill, because we do believe that it is time to reinvest in the Minnesota State Colleges and Universities to make up for the cuts from 2003, when that $191 million was cut from the base funding. Minsky makes up 64% of Minnesota's post-secondary institutions, with the 369,000 students that they currently have going there. And we do feel that through this bill, you would be able to fully fund inflation and fully fund tuition freeze, put some money into technology and the ongoing initiatives by the board. But the one thing that I would like to say is, you know, the importance of that is to remember that the majority of that needs to be ongoing funding. And I have talked briefly in the past, too, about where some of that money can come from. And I'm just going to reiterate those three areas real fast, quick, too. The Achieve 2 program is one that, as a student association, I've spoke to you about before, that we don't necessarily support the Achieve 2 program as proposed, because it targets a group of high school students that are graduating. There is money in K-12 right now, $73 million, that's targeting that same group of students for the same purpose, to get them better prepared for the college to the high school to college transition. And the $92 million of Achieve funding is ongoing funding that could be redirected to help students across the board. Another area that I've talked briefly about, and may not be as much about with this committee, is that the anticipated surplus from the state grant program. with the recent increases to the federal Pell Grant program, if I've done my math correctly, I believe that there's about $25 million of ongoing funding there that would be anticipated in that surplus, which could also be redirected to help more students. And then the last piece I'd like to say is I do believe that part of the Minsky request, too, with regard to the technology piece, could take some one-time funding where that wouldn't necessarily need to be ongoing money there. If you do the math, that's nearly $200 million in ongoing funding that could be redirected towards this bill, and that brings this proposal a lot closer to becoming a reality, and I would just like to encourage you to support that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Questions of witnesses? Is there anybody that wants to comment on the bill from the audience, like Minsky, or go ahead and stack on the...
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Russ Stanton, and I'm the Director of Government Relations for the State University faculty, the interfaculty organization. And I want to, on behalf of the IFO, strongly support this bill. We think that tuition has grown by grown far too fast over the last number of years. I passed out a couple of handouts. One of them shows what the tuition increases have been at state universities. In the last 6 years, they went up 70%. In the last 4 years, 54%. And it is driving many of our students deep in debt. It's causing them to stretch out their careers, and it's hard to measure how many people never showed up at your door because the price was too high, but we do believe that it is affecting access. And I think it's important to address why tuition has gone up so fast. And on the back side of the handout on tuition, there's a chart that says historical comparisons for Minsky institutions. And this chart looks complex. It's actually quite simple. The first column is simply the fiscal year. The second column is the actual appropriation that the state of Minnesota made each year since 1981 for Minsky institutions. The third column is the tuition revenue that was collected from the students. And the fourth and fifth columns are simply the percent paid by the student for operating the Minsky institutions and the percent paid by the state. And it really tells, I think, a very sad story. If you look back in 1981, the state was paying almost 80% of the cost of operating in our institutions. The students paid 20% in tuition. It slipped gradually. In the early 90s, we went to a formula of one-third, two-thirds, where the state was, it's still in statute, where the state was supposed to pay two-thirds of the cost, the students one-third through tuition. And we pretty much stuck with that formula up to 4 years ago, and then the bottom fell out of everything. If you look since fiscal 2002, the state share dropped from 66% down to 50%, and the student share went up to fill in the difference. And that's what caused those enormous tuition increases. If you look, the state appropriation in fiscal 2002, this is right out of the appropriation bill, was $601 million. 4 years later, last year, it was $600 million. That was $1 million less, despite the fact that inflation was 12% during that period of time, and despite the fact that enrollment in the Minsky institutions went up over 8,000 students, which is the size of a good-sized university. And basically, what has happened is the students have picked up the cost of the state not providing any inflation adjustments and keeping its funding up. It's all been passed over to the students, and we hope that this time that the students will get a little bit of relief. We know money is tight. We know that there's a lot of very worthy competing interests, but we hope that the state will prioritize funding higher education and providing some relief. We think this particular bill by Representative Hortman and Moe and others it is the right approach because it fills in for the lost revenue from the tuition freeze by appropriating state dollars. If you just freeze the tuition and don't supply the dollars, it leaves a big hole in the Minsky budget and it would require all sorts of cuts to occur. So One other last thing before I conclude, I would just like to remind this committee of before you start appropriating money in a few weeks. And this is from Governing Magazine, which is a magazine for state and local government officials. It's up in your library upstairs. That's where I copied this from. And the 2002 edition, it shows the every year they do a ranking of state spending on issues like higher education, et cetera. And back 4 years ago in 2002, they gave our rank as 20th among the 50 states, among the 50 states in terms of per capita support of higher education. If you did it as a percent of personal income, we were 33%. We ranked 31 out of the 50 states. If you look on the back side of that handout, it gives the from last year's report that just came out in November, and we've slipped from 20th, a ranking of 20th, to a ranking of 30th among the 50 states. And we now have states like Alabama and Mississippi that spend more per capita on higher education than Minnesota does. And as somebody that was around here back when it used to be 80-20, it really kind of makes me want to weep to see how far we slipped, and I hope that this will be the session we start to turn the corner.
Representative Ruth.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I certainly agree that we need to help out our colleges, and I'm all for it, all our students. But I just want to make sure that we keep the story straight and remember that the grant program in Minnesota is much more generous than many other states. And for I don't know if it's this year, but I know in the past years, Minnesota has ranked third in affordability because of the generous grant program that we have. So while it isn't as much coming, you know, we say in actual tuition dollars coming from the state, but there are grant programs. And after the $4.5 billion deficit when we were attacked in 2001, I remember that year that we put, in 2002, we put more dollars into the actual grants so that the students would be able to get them, so that everybody would be able to afford to go to college.
Mr. Chair. I guess in response to that, the one thing I'd point out is 80% of our students don't get a grant. They just got the tuition increase. The grant is pretty much concentrated on the low-income students. You have to have a very low family income. Most of our working-class kids just paid more tuition.
You know, we've got a number of bills on tuition today, and Mr. Berg informed me earlier today that I think we've got about $680 million in requests so far on bills. I assume deed and the governor's bills and everything else.
Oh, that doesn't count the governor's.
Oh, that doesn't count the governor's. Okay. So this is just requests. You know, this bill, Representative Hartman, is just a mere $350 million. So I'm going to ask you, like I'm going to ask everybody else, how would you pay for it? Maybe I should have asked the two students, too, but I'll ask you and put you on the spot.
Sure. Yeah. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I think there are a few different things we can do. Of course, I think the Achieve 2 program doesn't serve as many students as freezing tuition would. So when you look at the $92 million, if we appropriated that towards tuition reduction on an ongoing basis, we'd have $19 million a year left over. However, I'm aware, as all of you are, that the governor's proposed budget for Minsky and the University of Minnesota is $197 million less than what they asked for. So that $92 million isn't all that we need from the Achieve 2 program. I think we have to look at closing corporate tax loopholes. The foreign operating corporation tax loophole, my understanding is, could generate up to $180 million a year on the low side. The high side, the aggressive side, where we're probably not headed, would be more like $300 million a year. Increased tax compliance on the low end is $100 million a year. On the high end is $300 million a year. And so I think if we make it a priority to keep tuition in check, we can find the revenues. You look at $24 million in fiscal 2008, I think we can find that.
Okay. Good answer. Does the Minsky have anything to Minsky support this bill? Well, Mr. Ullman, I think that was your teacher up there. So maybe you could come and tell us where you would find the money. Having been a former state rep that came in with me,
And by the way, Bernie Oman is 100% Slovenian. See, I know that. Him and former Senator Janicic are both, ironically, 100% Slovenian. They're lobbying for Minsky, and Slovenians are really good at finding money. In fact, we kind of say they're a little parsimonious up in my neck of the woods. So where would you find money?
Well, Mr. Chairman, Bernie Oman with the Office of the Chancellor. First of all, let me just go back to the question that was raised before on the issue of the one resident tuition rate. It's very difficult for us to predict washes on students and when campuses decide whether or not they want to put a higher rate on some out-of-state students and predict what the future is going to be. We can only give you a fiscal note that's based on fact, on what is actually there. That's point one. Point two is it has been a standing policy with a very strong encouragement of the legislature that we do provide campus autonomy, and setting some tuition rates is a important thing on autonomy that campuses certainly would like. As far as the tuition, I can simply reiterate the answer that the chancellor made when he was in front of this committee, is that the Minsky board has said that they will not increase tuition above 4% per year, no matter what happens during the legislative process. And the feeling was from the board to bring a balanced approach to the legislature. Now, a 4% tuition increase is around $160 to $175, $180 per year. Yes, it is true. We would like to obviously have enough money in the system to be able to do a 0% tuition increase. However, that was not something that was felt by the board that we could bring to the legislature and have the money to do. But if there is money available, obviously, and the direction is to do a 0% tuition increase, that is something that the board would obviously follow.
Representative Mahoney, do you have a question? Ms. Hortman or the Representative Hortman or Mr. Holman?
I just wanted to respond to Representative Ruth's comment that neither one of my two children ever got a scholarship or grant, I should put it, or any help, and it all came out of my particular pocket. And unfortunately, I'm just a poor working stiff from the middle class, and it's been very difficult for those two.
Yeah, that big salary you get here at the Capitol plus that big journeyman salary.
With all the time I have to take off for the Capitol, yeah.
Representative Ruth.
Well, I'm one of those stiffs, too, because our kids didn't get any help either. But you know what? I think we need to look at it, that 20% did. We're talking about 80% didn't, but you know what? 20% did. And the idea we got those grants is so that we could get to kids who weren't going to have help from their parents or their relatives or who knows what or have. Or my husband had three jobs, you know, uphill both ways. So, I mean, but we got through. But it's really for those kids who really don't have a way of getting there. And so 20% we're able to.
Well, Representative Ruth, I kind of still, it's not that far back for me to remember some of the sad stories that we heard just from the people that came here 2 months ago or a month and a half ago from the students.
Mr. Chairman.
And to hear from some of those students, you know, that have $20,000 in debt going to a technical college, I don't, and some of the other ones, $40,000 to $60,000, I don't know what kind of jobs are available out there for them to get out of debt.
Mr. Chair, I want to comment on that point, because I think when you look at the numbers in the November forecast that were confirmed in the February forecast, housing starts are down 40% in Minnesota. How is a kid coming out of college today, whether it's at age 21, 22, or 28, supposed to buy a house with the amount of debt that they're carrying? And building houses is the first domino in a lot of economic activity in the state of Minnesota. And I think we have to look at ourselves and say, we've got some real economic storm clouds on the horizon because of these housing starts numbers. What's contributing to that? And I think high tuition is contributing to those low housing starts numbers.
Hartman, they already have a house mortgage, but they don't have a house.
Mr. Chairman, I'll be very, very brief. The other point that sometimes we miss in this discussion on the tuition increases that have happened in the past several years, the budget reductions that happened in 2003 and 2004 were not reductions based on our wish list. These were real dollar reductions that Mr. Stanton articulated before. These were dollar reductions in our base money. It was not a reduction of our request. And I don't want to leave the table thinking that we are against this bill.
However, the feeling was of the board to bring a balanced approach, and if the money is available, we'd be more than happy to comply.
Okay. No further questions? Oh, Representative Breiner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Earlier, I was going to ask Representative Hortman about the fiscal note, but we've had quite extensive discussion on that. But I just want to reiterate what I said about the earlier bill, and that's that I'm very strongly philosophically supportive of this bill. But I still, myself, am not convinced that we'll be able to fund it. But I do appreciate that Mr. Formo did bring to the table several concrete suggestions for how to do that. I've challenged him over the months to do that, and he has done it. So I think I appreciate that effort, and we'll certainly look at those suggestions.
Thank you. Representative Gunther or Eastland, which one wants to step up to the plate next? Representative Eastland? House File 783, and Representative Farland, would you move the minutes of yesterday's meeting?
Yes, so moved.
I'm sure you've read them,
Mr. Chair. I did read
thoroughly,
them.
And no additions or corrections. If there are none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Representative Eastland has moved that House File. Where am I here? House File 783 be recommended to pass and placed for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education and Finance Bill. Representative Eastland, thank you. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee. I served on the Higher Education Committee for the last 4 years, and we have heard much testimony prior to what we've heard this year about the tuition issues and the increases and how they've been affecting students. And I think the message was loud and clear that it's very, very difficult to live when tuitions are going up 15% a year. Because there wasn't a lot of money that was going into the system last year, I introduced this bill, and I'm going to introduce it again this year. And what this does is it does not add money to the system, but what it does is it gives students and families of students the ability to have a better planning tool when they do get into the college system. And so this actually did come to me from a student who had this idea after we had a meeting in my office with the attack with the tuition freeze students that were around in the last couple of years, and they said this would be a tool that would be helpful even if there was no more money that went into the system. And what this does is it actually allows students to plan their college career and know what the tuition is going to be when they start for all 4 years or 5 years as the case may be. It's called a tuition cap, but really what it does is it guarantees tuition. So when you enter college, what happens is there's a guaranteed entry rate, and that rate remains the same for 5 years at the institution. That seemed a little unfair to the institution to say they had to guarantee a rate for 5 years, and so I did put a clause in here that simply says that the institution can raise it at the rate of inflation, which is measured by the CPI. And so simply what the bill does is it says that when you enter college, the college is required to give you a five-year tuition guarantee, and each year they can raise it, the CPI. And so what the bill would eventually do is it would take away the huge spikes that occur in the tuition process. There are a number of states that do this. There are a number of colleges that do it. In fact, I found another very interesting proposal that Washington State has just put into effect I'd like to talk about and introduce a bill for that also does not cost any money, but it's a management tool that helps the student and puts the student in control of knowing what the tuition is going to be for the 4 years of the college career. We don't have any jurisdiction over the University of Minnesota, so basically what this would do is require MNSCU to initiate this kind of a program, and it would request the University of Minnesota to do the same. That's basically the gist of the bill.
Questions on the bill, Representative Eastland. Any testimony from the audience or the university or MNSCU? Nobody's. I guess my question would be, obviously there's been spikes in costs, whether it's for heating fuels or things like that, different spikes that I don't know if the CPI Urban would cover them or not, but you also have the textbook issue as an example, and which is probably an increase far beyond CPI. There are probably some costs to the university and to Minskew's system that they couldn't absorb under this, and I'm just wondering how you would address that, Representative Easton.
The bill particularly, I think, addresses tuition. I don't think it addresses a lot of the other. It specifically focused on tuition. And what the bill does is it leaves some flexibility for the institution. Rather than just imposing a tuition freeze and saying that the institution must meet the freeze, I think we all know what happens then. Services suffer. Because if they're required to operate with the same requirements to perform and they have less money, services suffer. So what this bill does, it allows the institutions to set the tuition for every entering student at whatever level is appropriate. And so if the entering level student this year goes in at $100, the entry level student next year may go in at $105 or $110. But when you enter, that is the tuition that you are guaranteed for the year. So the university or the school, the college or the Minskew institution would have the option to increase tuition for entering students, but it would be guaranteed for the full 5 years.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, just a comment. If this would be approved, our daughter's graduating this spring, our youngest, so I wouldn't be able to take advantage of it, but it would set the stage for a student to budget themselves or parents budget themselves, like if you were to buy a house or buy a car, you are on a payment which stays for the length of your loan or whatever. So I think it's a good thing that we should really take a look at.
Representative Poppy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, I'd be intrigued by this proposal. I do have a question, though. Certainly, I work at a college, and I'd be concerned about the business office and the registrar's office because students come every semester, new students, and including the summer session, and so you'd have multiple levels of tuition that many students would be paying, and I'm just wondering, as far as fiscally, how much this would perhaps cost and just the flow of how it could actually work.
Representative Easton.
Mr. Chair, there are a number of colleges that do this that have not indicated that it costs any more to manage it internally. I think we have pretty good technology inside to be able to manage how the tuition flows. I have not seen a fiscal note, but we did have a fiscal note that I think in the Senate, and I believe that came back as no cost. So I may be incorrect, but I'm not sure.
Mr. Berg might have a different opinion on that.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Eastland, members, first I apologize. There are fiscal notes on all of these bills that need them, and there was a little mix-up, and they're not in your packet, but I can make them available if you want them. There isn't a state cost to Representative Eastland's bill. There is none shown on the front. There's discussion by the two systems of how this would be, how this would affect their revenues. The two systems take different approaches to the way they cost these types of items. Minskew has simply said, we assume that we will raise tuition at 4% a year, and this would limit us to the CPI at 2% a year. The gap between those would lose them $22 million in revenue in 2010 and $44 million in 2011. The university, however, says that there is no restriction on the price that a incoming freshman cohort has to pay, and we can set it wherever we want, so we can set it at a level that we don't lose revenue at, and are, you know, then allowed a CPI increase in there. So if you want to look at it as strictly a limitation on the existing flow of tuition, there's a gap in revenue, but if you want to look at it that the systems can price their product anywhere they want, for each incoming class in this bill, there doesn't have to be a revenue impact at all.
Any comments from anyone in the audience on this approach? Mr. Zetterberg, on down. Throw your weight around on this issue.
Mr. Chair, for the record, my name is Peter Zetterberg. I work for the University of Minnesota. In a perfect world, this would be a perfect tuition plan. And actually, you don't even need the CPI feature to it to increase rates. As different cohorts move through, since they're all paying, the seniors are paying less than the juniors are paying less than the sophomores, once you've had this in place for 4 or 5 years, all you need to do is increase tuition for incoming freshmen, but your overall revenue is going to go up by the same amount because the seniors are gone. Every class is now paying 3 or 4 or 5% more. So once you've reached that kind of stability, all you indeed need to do is raise tuition for freshmen. We had a guaranteed tuition plan for undergraduate students at the university for 10 years, and we eliminated it 2 years ago only because of lack of interest on the part of students and their families who bought at the much higher rate we were asking them to pay as freshmen. They'd look at that difference and they, we guaranteed they would never pay more, but it turned out that only 100 to 150 each year were interested in doing it. It did cost us a lot to maintain a program for just that few students, which is why we did away with it. The one problem, however, with this plan, and the state of Illinois, which now does it in all public institutions, has evidently resolved it, is financial aid. Pell grants are the same amount for all students, regardless of what they're paying. So a Pell grant would be much more meaningful for a senior than it would be for a freshman. And there's nothing you can do about that at the federal level. At the state level, you would have to adjust your state grant program to take into account the fact that you always need to give more aid to a freshman than you do to a senior. The other major problem is that the federal loan programs, which are the most heavily used, also actually allow freshmen and sophomores to borrow less than juniors and seniors. But with a plan like this, it would always be freshmen and sophomores who are paying more than juniors and seniors are paying. So financial aid is actually the biggest stumbling block. And then, of course, this isn't the perfect world. No one's responsible for what happened in 2003, but it did happen. And a plan like this, I think, is really only feasible if institutions are able to count on a great deal of stability in the other revenue source. And for public higher education, that, of course, is state funding. And if you've locked yourself into a guarantee like this and you suddenly lose 15% of your state funding, there's really not a whole lot you can do about it unless you load it all onto freshmen, and that becomes rather impractical. But otherwise, this tuition plan does, in fact, have a great deal to commend itself.
Okay. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Eastland. Nice, interesting discussion. Representative Gunther moves House File 901 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Higher Education Finance and Workforce Development Bill. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. This is what I call a little breath of fresh air bill. We all know, because of the chairman's great overviews, what's happening to college students today. And in Minsky, as it was in the two-year vocational schools, we have the second highest tuition in the nation. We get a D for affordability. We get A's and B's for everything else. When you look at the state's contribution to this dilemma, you look at, we went from 67% to 49%, 50% of the state's portion of paying for higher education. I think the students deserve a breath of fresh air. Minsky is suggesting a 4% tuition increase. U of M suggesting a 4.5% increase. I just want to reduce both of them 1%. Not a lot. It's affordable. And after chairing a committee that had decreases of 35%, if somebody would have given me a 1% decrease I had to find, I know I could find it without even opening my eyes. I think Minsky and the university can do the same thing. So what I'm suggesting is simply a little breath of fresh air. I'm not going as far as Representative Hortman did, but I'm a fiscal conservative. And I think this is going to be a help. I have another bill in another committee that I hope will come to this committee that will take students that graduate and have their student loans be paid for with before tax dollars. I think that's going to keep Minnesota graduates in Minnesota, or help keep them here. But this one is just a little bit of help, and that's what I propose.
Well, thank you
for questions.
Gunther, any questions? Representative Gunther, I mean, it's a simplistic approach and a request only by the university, but you remember what President Brunick said, that you know, they had $184, I believe, million-dollar request over the biennium, and I think the governor gave them $122 of ongoing money. And so, am I right on those figures? What's a million here or there? But anyway,
$122 ongoing.
You know, and Minsky was the same. I think $179 million and only $70-some million dollars of ongoing. So how, with that, them not getting that, Representative Gunther, we can ask them to cut their tuition another 1.5% is kind of difficult. But that's okay. You can do it because you're state rep and you get the right laws.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you got to remember the request from Minsky and the university for all facets of the university. I'm looking after just a little bit of help for the students.
Okay. Thank you, Representative Gunther. Now, Representative Paulson. Representative Ruth moves that House File 1379 be recommended to pass and held over for possible inclusion in the Omnibus Higher Education Finance Bill, and Workforce Development Bill, and whatever other things we decide to put, Workers' Comp Bill, whatever. Representative Paulson, welcome to the committee. It's a pleasure to see you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate the opportunity to be here as well. Mr. Chair, members, this bill is simply a piece of legislation that would authorize a grant program to be established for encouraging students, whether you're in public or private college, those institutions, to acquire more of a global perspective by having the opportunity to live and study abroad in a foreign country as part of their post-secondary experience. Members, the proposal would be a grant program that would be administered by HESO. Priorities would be given to areas of study that are traditionally underrepresented in study abroad programs and areas and cultures that are traditionally underrepresented. Students would have to commit to learning in the host country's language as well as learn the customs and culture of a host country. There would be a maximum amount that would be placed on for grants that would be awarded to $10,000 as well for a student. The language was actually drafted by some folks at the University of Minnesota that are involved in their study abroad program, and I have someone from the university who was not able to be here today because of an emergency with a student. And the language, much of the language in the bill, actually, Mr. Chairman, was taken from a federal commission, some recommendations from a federal commission, as well as some recently passed federal legislation. So I'm offering this as a perspective, really, because I think the study abroad experience does show that students who have had that opportunity, and many don't get that opportunity because it is expensive, but students who do have that opportunity, the statistics show that they graduate quicker, they graduate faster than traditional students have that opportunity. I think it's partly because they learn to be more flexible and adaptive in different cultures and different situations. That's in a nutshell, Mr. Chair, then.
Thank you, Representative Paulson. I just love it when I see a good fiscal conservative spending money like me. So I guess my question to you is, I think it's a great idea. My daughter had the opportunity to go study one semester abroad, and my son did it on his own. He just got back from Nicaragua. I can't mention that here. He's fighting some stomach virus yet. But anyway, where are you going to get the $10 million for this? And does the office, Ms. Hegar, to support the bill?
Mr. Chair, I have not spoken to Ms. Hegard, and actually I'm working with Senator Pogemiller, fiscal conservative, working with Senator Pogemiller on the Senate side as well on this initiative, Mr. Chair. And obviously I understand that is a challenge for you, Mr. Chair, and the committee members with the requests you have from the Minsky system and the University of Minnesota. I certainly understand that, and the state grant program as well. And so, you know, I'm just hoping that this is an idea you would consider, because there is value to it. I think whether it's your family members or others that get that experience, there is certainly value, especially if those students return to Minnesota and are able to offer perspectives from in the global economy and be here in the state.
And that's a very good political answer. I want to know where you're going to get the $10 million. Income tax increases on the rich. Come on, come say that for me.
Mr. Chair, I'm not even sure your own tax chair supports that.
Representative Brian. Well, I would be, Representative Brian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Paulson, I'm just wondering if in the course of doing research on this bill, you're aware of what type of funding is available in the state currently for study abroad programs.
Representative Paulson. Mr. Chair and Representative Brian, it's different for different institutions, obviously, but in talking with the University of Minnesota, I believe that 10 years ago they had no money available for this, and now they
have approximately $500,000 available per year for this type of initiative. Other schools are able to do things on their own, I think through some private scholarship or foundation opportunities, and that's the best of my research that I have right now.
Okay, any other questions? If not, members, next week we, I believe, have a pretty ambitious schedule. We're going to start meeting. Thank you, Representative Paulson. We'll see what we can do for you. We're going to start meeting Monday night. We've got about, I think, 15 bills maybe on Monday night, and we've got Tuesday all day, our regular meeting date, and then I think we have Tuesday night or Wednesday night. Oh, come on. We got to start moving here. Okay, well then, we do have a Monday night meeting scheduled with a huge amount of bills, so we're going to be here Monday night. Representative Murphy, I think you do have a bill up next week, if I'm not mistaken. I don't know if it's that night meeting or not. Okay, members, meeting adjourned.